You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And I'm Antonia Yuhas.
And as of this morning, Yosemite National Park is closed due to wildfire. 38,000 people have been evacuated because of the car fire that is north of Redding. 7 confirmed deaths in that fire. The fastest growing complex of fires in California is currently in Mendocino and Lake counties, where some 10,000 people are under evacuation orders. There are 12,000 firefighters, many of them from out of state, working 24-hour shifts in California. And in some places, these fires are burning so intensely, they are generating their own weather patterns. Tornado-like winds, powerful enough to pull down trees and blow the roofs off homes. The big question here is, like, is this just an exceptional year that it's this intense and this early? Is this the new normal? Is this a consequence of decades of mismanagement of fuel loads and fire-prone lands? Or is this climate change? Or some combination of all of the above. We're joined now by Gary Ferguson. He's a longtime environment writer, most recently author of Land on Fire, The New Reality of Wildfire in the West. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Brian and Antonia. Thank you.
So why is it so bad right now?
Well, you hit upon in your latter comment the fact that it may be a combination of things. And in fact, it is. Way back in the 1920s, we got it into our minds that fire was bad. It was just an evil that needed to be fought at all costs. And we were awfully good at fighting fire. The problem with that is that fire can be a very healthy ingredient in the ecosystem. It actually burns through, eliminates diseases, pathogens in the forest. But more importantly, in the arid West, if you have trees and branches fall on the ground, the only way that so-called biomass gets returned to the earth is through fire, because it's so arid, we don't have the kind of decomposition organisms that they do elsewhere in the country. So by putting out all the fires, we essentially allow that fuel load to build up. And so instead of these regular so-called stand maintenance fires that were naturally occurring every 10 to 12 years, burning around 1,400 degrees, 3 to 5 foot flames, now we have 2,000 degree fires, 150-foot flames. Now you combine that error, which we started to try to correct in the mid-1980s, of letting all the fuel load build up, you combine that with climate change. Climate change is a major factor with what we're dealing with as far as these fires. But you put those two things together, and it's pretty clear to me and a lot of other fire ecologists that this is going to be the way things are for a very long time to come.
Can you talk more about those specific conditions of climate change that are intensifying and increasing the frequency of these fires?
Sure. Whenever you have a rise in temperature, and we've seen about a degree and a half to 2 degrees over the past century, one of the effects is humidity goes down. So as humidity decreases, the fuel moisture load, they call it, in the forest drops precipitously. In fact, in some of the dry fuels, the trees that have fallen on the ground and the trees that have been killed by, say, pine bark beetles, there are moisture levels in California now that are about 8% and 9%. Now, to give you an idea of what that means, kiln-dried lumber is dried to about 11% to 12%. So we've got forests filled with timber that is more flammable than the lumberyard, essentially. We've got prolonged droughts. We've broken the record for the planet's hottest year 5 times since 2000, the last time being in 2017. Those droughts stress trees. They make them more vulnerable to things like beetles and other sorts of pathogens, and it kills them sometimes directly as well. It's really sobering to me. If you look at the year 2016, there were 62 million trees that died in California, and a lot of that was drought-related stress. Not all of it, but a fair amount of it. So we're creating this fuel load at the very time we're trying to get a handle on these fires, and it's a very, very challenging time for California and the whole interior West.
So can you describe, like, how the impacts of a fire that is burning that much more intensely are different from the type of maintenance fires that you described as part of the natural regime?
Sure. And some of the worst of the fires, firefighters have started referring to as mega fires. And mega fires are loosely defined as 100,000 acre fires or more. The Carr fire is getting very close to 100,000 acres. We used to have those, by the way, very, very rarely, a few times a century, but now we've had 12 years since 2000 with 12 mega fires in the interior West and California in each of those years. The effect of that kind of hot fire is that it can, it doesn't always, but it can sterilize soil. Now, what that leads to, if the soil is actually sterilized, burned so hot by these more fuel-laden fires, is that the regeneration of vegetation, which is the vegetation has evolved to be very, very quick to take advantage of all the nutrients that fires leave in the soil in the wake of the, in the ashes. But if the soil is sterilized, those plants can't get a hold. And in that case, you start to get debris slides like we saw last year in Southern California. So that's one of the effects. And the longer those slopes remain destabilized by not having vegetation, the more likely they are to slumping and the more likely they are to put silt into the streams and damage fisheries. So that's just one consequence. Also, when you have a fire that burns that hot, when pioneer species do start to take over that forest, a lot of times it's going to be invasive plants like cheatgrass that seem to have evolved to have a particularly good ability to claim fire that's soil that's been sterilized recently. So it's a real difficult problem. You mentioned those winds, those fire whirls, as they're called. That's another aspect often of big fires. And when you have those winds, you mentioned they can knock down trees. They can actually pull trees up into the sky. And the dangerous thing about that is that they send off embers into housing developments. So it isn't usually a wall of flames necessarily that burns a housing development. It's a shower of embers from a fire maybe a mile or two away. And those fire whirls are a big part of that.
There's also been, I hear firefighters saying each year increasingly, the unpredictability of the wind patterns. They used to be able to know if I stand here, I'll be able to block a fire knowing that it's coming in this direction. But that the fires have become increasingly unpredictable, particularly the winds. Is that an effect of climate change that you can discuss?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you, Antonia. It's two things going on. Yes, globally, winds have increased by about 10%. In the last 25 years due to climate change. Now, they don't increase equally around the planet. So in some cases, they increase more significantly. And California looks like it may be one of those places. The other thing is, despite the fact that we're getting these wonderful high-tech apps available to firefighters so they can pinpoint weather forecasts in ways that they've never been able to before, the weather generated by the fire itself, as you mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, is so unpredictable, and there is really no understanding of it to map into those applications how a particular fire of a particular size burning in a certain landscape with certain draws and wind conditions and fuel load moistures. We don't really know how that weather that the fire is creating is going to be acting. And this is an especially dangerous time for both residents, but also firefighters. We're now at a point where wildland firefighters, they only make up 5% of the firefighting force as a whole in the nation, but they die at a rate of about five times greater than domestic urban firefighters. So it's a very dangerous time for firefighters out there and of course for people who live in those canyons where these winds are kicking up.
So we've got two confirmed deaths among the firefighting personnel in the Carr fire. Can you describe what the circumstances are of firefighter deaths? My understanding is most of the work happens quite a ways back from the fire line, trying to create breaks or barriers to the fire's progress.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And safety is always, always, always the first and top concern. There has been such an evolution in the last 40 years of protocol and how we fight fires, how we establish communication, how we know the right hand, what the left hand is doing. That said, one of the firefighters who died, I believe, first in the Carr fire was digging fire line with a bulldozer. Now, the way fires are fought, when you hear that they're 5% contained or 30% contained, firefighters are going around the perimeter of the fire near the front, if they can, safely, and digging lines anywhere from 3 to 10 foot wide. And then they're setting fires that, because of the oxygen that the fire a mile or half mile away is drawing, will draw the fires they set back to the fire. That eliminates the fuel load and keeps the fire from advancing. But what often happens, and I'm not sure if that's what happened with the bulldozer driver, is fires will, what's called spot. And that means because of a fire whirl or just simply because of the heat of the fire and how high up those embers and burning pine cones are going, the winds will blow them on the other side of the firefighters, so on the back side of the fire line. Now, if that happens, all of a sudden they can find themselves trapped between two walls of fire. And all you combine that with very unpredictable winds, as Antonia was mentioning earlier, and that's what makes firefighting so dangerous right now.
And can you also talk about the cumulative now building up of these fires? Because obviously for many of us, it feels like we just finished the last devastating fire in this area and now there is another one. It doesn't even feel like there's been an interval. And you're saying one of the problems that we're facing is that there isn't the opportunity for the soil to build up these nutrients again. So we've got a cumulative worsening each year. Is that right? And is that the, you know, the present and the future that we're looking for towards, is that there isn't an opportunity for the land to restore itself, to stop fire on its own?
Well, that's true in some places. And that, again, causes siltation in rivers and it causes debris slides and those sorts of problems. The problem with a lot of the forest beyond that, though, that we need to tackle has to do with the fuel load. And that means some serious prescribed burning, which, unfortunately, many of the agencies responsible for putting out fires also are the agencies responsible for doing things like prescribed burning and thinning operations where that's appropriate. And they don't have any money left. The Forest Service is spending now 70%+ of its budget just on fighting fires. And so that's the agency that would go in and help thin forests, especially around neighborhoods. They don't have the money to do that anymore. So prescribed burning, thinning operations, but also I really want to mention the wildland-urban interface. And that's what, it's a chewy term for any of us who live in areas of natural vegetation that have a possibility of burning. And that's about a third of the American population. It's a staggering number of millions and millions of people. Unfortunately, at this point, only 3% of the communities, some 22,000 communities, have taken steps to make their communities what are called fire safe. Doesn't guarantee that your community won't burn, but it's a set of very simple procedures that have to do with cutting back vegetation around your house, putting mesh screens over vent openings, making sure your gutters are cleaned out, cleaning out the short trees and shrubs under the tall trees. The very, very simple things, but we're to the point where, again, only 3% of the communities have done this. Now, if you doubt the effectiveness of such a simple thing, there was a fire in Colorado Springs not too many years ago, where in one community that had made that a priority to do those sorts of fire mediation efforts, out of 65 homes, they lost 3. Right next door in Cathedral Pines, they didn't do those mitigation procedures, and they lost 62 homes out of 69. So it makes a phenomenal difference. There's great help out there of people who know how to assist. We just really need to push forward with those kinds of committed efforts in our communities.
And that's not just a question of the well-being of the people in those homes, but a question of how much firefighting resources those homes are going to divert from the rest of the fire area.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because the firefighters will always go to where structures are and where people are. That's where the resources, as you put it, will be diverted always. And so the more fire-safe communities we have, the more resources we'll have to deal with the forest itself.
Let's talk about budgeting real quickly. So there was an Obama-era program that was a public-private partnership where the federal government would put up half the money if a homeowner would put up the other half to protect itself. Doing this, as you're saying, the burns of trees near their area and making their own home fire safe. Is that a program that has continued, and what does the budgeting look like for these programs under the Trump administration?
Yeah, that program has continued sort of out of the momentum it gained under the Obama administration. It's very much up in the air as far as whether or not it will be continue to be funded. And it's critical. What's happening is private nonprofit groups, like one is called Headwaters Economics out of Montana, are showing up with massive amounts of grant money to go in and help communities all over the country. They give 2-3 day workshops on how to do the work that we're talking about. That's coming online. I believe you'll see, as wildfires continue to devastate structures, we've lost just in the Carr Fire 500 so far and 5,000 more threatened. I think you're going to see insurance companies step in fairly soon and also start funding some of these education programs and these mitigation programs. I don't know what's going to happen with the federal government dollars. It's anybody's guess at this point. Everybody is holding their breath that they stay somewhat stable.
Well, it's one thing for insurers to educate their clients. Isn't there a question of whether they should just yank the underwriting on homes that are built in areas that regularly burnt down?
Yes, you're right. And I think, Brian, that's possible. The more losses insurance companies sustain, you know, compared to a bad hurricane or a major flood, the losses have not been historically as significant with wildfire. Wildfire is very quickly catching up with those other natural disasters. And so I think insurance companies will be making that decision. You know, another thing.
But we measure the losses, to be clear, when we tally up the damages, we measure the losses to private property at the assessed value of that property. If what's happening when homes are in the line of fire is they're diverting firefighting personnel who might otherwise be keeping that fire from tearing through a national forest or a national park, there's immense ecosystem damages that don't wind up in the ledger.
That's entirely correct. Yes, yes. We do not put, typically most people do not put a price tag on the natural resources that have been destroyed. And it isn't just the timber value, the fisheries value, it's the carbon storage value of these forests. You know, the forests of the planet are storing about half of the excess carbon dioxide that humans are producing and contributing to climate change right now. So as these forests burn down, there's that loss to account for as well. And they're not doing that. I should mention also elsewhere in the country, California has gotten better and better at this, but in a lot of the West, county commissioners especially are still not insisting that development be done in a way that makes it less prone to fire, using green belts and green spaces as essentially fire lines, buffer zones, having regulations as far as how close houses can be together, so they don't have this sort of torch effect where one burns, it lights off the other ones. And there's a growing unrest in an awful lot of people in the rest of the country to look at these Western states and say, if you're not going to implement the most basic fire safety protocols when a new development occurs, then why should we as taxpayers be paying these billions of dollars at this point to defend these kinds of subdivisions? And I think you're going to see a lot of arguments, shall we say, about that in the coming years.
A number of Northern California cities, including San Francisco, are suing oil companies for the costs of climate change. And Santa Cruz is a county that's suing oil companies for the costs incurred for fighting fires caused by climate change, suing the oil companies to get those costs back. What do you think about that?
You know, personally, I don't know that I have a lot of faith that will carry the day in our current legal system, but I'm intrigued by it. And it actually is, in my thinking, based on a very strong reality. The fire season has grown by 75 days since 1972. 75 days of extra fire season. So that's, and this is the first year, as you may have heard or even mentioned to your listeners, where California will not have a single month that isn't a fire season month. That's never happened in the history of anywhere in the United States. So, yes, and a significant amount of this is happening because of climate change. So at least partially, I think they're on solid ground. How one makes that legal argument and how it's likely to be interpreted, certainly if they prevailed, it would, as you can imagine, open up a tremendous can of worms for lots and lots of things going on related to climate change. But climate change is with us, and we really need to deal with it in the strongest terms possible. And this is one of those ways.
Unpack that statistic for us. What is it? How is a fire season defined?
Well, a fire season is defined by that point. And of course, this is a general definition. Every particular regional landscape would have its own version of this. But a fire season in the West, and that's what I'm talking about, is defined when a significant, and it's usually over 50% of the natural environment, the vegetation in that in those natural environments, reach a moisture level where they are prone under the right, you know, fire, somebody sparks a fire or lightning strikes, where it's prone to burn, to turn into a wildfire. And so typically that would have started in a lot of the interior West, again, very different in Southern California, but a lot of the interior West, that would have started typically in late May through the third week of June. Now it's way back in the spring and it's way forward in the fall. One of the things that's happening due to climate change, and this is related, is the snowpack, including in the Sierras, is melting typically earlier and earlier. Well, when that snowpack melts, it not only diminishes what's contributed to the water downstream that people need to live on, but it also opens up the forest to the drying, desiccating effects of the wind and the sun. So you've got that, you suddenly got a forest with no snow in it, and it's turning into tinder, it's turning into a fire-prone ecosystem much sooner than it used to. And so that's what that statistic is about.
Gary Ferguson, we talked about climate change. We talked about poor fuel management practices in California's wildlands. The one thing we haven't talked about yet is invasive species. Here in our more urbanized area of the East Bay Hills, there's tremendous concern about the inflammatory potential of eucalyptus trees, scotch brooms, other species that have replaced a natural landscape that customarily burned, but not very intensely. And in the East Bay Hills fire, some of those plants were described as acting like cans of gasoline once they were exposed to a spark. How much has it changed to the biological regime a part of what we're seeing now?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and it's a significant amount. There are about 100 million acres infested by cheatgrass throughout the West right now. That's a Eurasian invasive plant that takes over, starves out other plants, and becomes, by about the middle of June, flash paper. If you drop a match into dried cheatgrass, it flashes through the forest like nothing you've ever seen. And of course, that creates some big fire danger. Certainly, scotch broom burns much, much hotter, and other plants that are being planted in California that I'm probably not aware of. It's true, we should try as much as possible to get more native vegetation wherever we can. The answer is not to eliminate vegetation altogether. I mean, that can create lots of increased runoff, loss of soil, loss of fertility. So that isn't the answer. But to the extent it's possible, and this is not a no-cost idea, to take some of this non-native vegetation out and put more native plants in, it would be a good idea, primarily for the reason you're talking about, the heat that's generated when the plants burn. And that heat is a relative factor for how fast the fire spreads. The hotter a plant burns, the sooner it spreads it to the next plant.
So we've got some answers here, which is more money for prescribed burns, making sure that homeowners take the precautions that are necessary or not build in areas that are particularly prone to fire. But what are some of the longer term solutions that we should be looking at? Are people going to need to move out of areas entirely that are potentially fire prone? And didn't you say something like a third of the population is living in these in between areas? What do you see as the long term actions that should be taken?
Well, I think as far as most of the people who are living in the wildland urban interface, it's a matter of protecting their own individual homes and neighborhoods and then going out into the forested or vegetated area within 500 yards or so of those homes and just thinning and managing. Because if you have a thinned, healthy forest and the trees are, say, ponderosa pine, for instance, in some parts of California, if you have healthy trees, they're fire resistant. Trees evolved to be fire resistant. And if you go in and take out those so-called smaller trees, which are called ladder trees because they allow fires to climb up into the bigger trees, if you space out the trees by trimming away some of the competing vegetation, you won't have these tightly bunched clusters of fuel. So I think a lot of it actually can be done through careful management, but it's a painstaking process.
And to be clear, the tightly bunched clusters you're describing, they're a byproduct of logging. That's a second growth pattern in mature forests.
Yes. That certainly can be. And there's another issue with logging. Not that logging is all bad, but in addition to what you just mentioned, if you start logging in the way we did for so much of the 20th century in very big clear cuts, what happens is, and then sometimes we went in and actually planted the species that were most commercially viable, we get even age stands. And even age conifer stands are exactly what pine bark beetles love most. So we're almost planting the next tinderbox, you know, 60 or 80 years later, when we go in and have that sort of uneven age stand dominate the landscape. Yes.
And that's because all of the trees are vulnerable at the same time. So you have an entire stand die at once when the pine beetle hits it.
That's right. The pine bark beetle will go on either side of a certain age of tree, depending on how voracious and hungry it is. But typically, an early mature, sort of a young middle-aged stand, reaches the point where the conditions are best for the pine bark beetles to bore in, lay their eggs, and have those eggs successfully hatch and occupy the tree the following season. You know, we didn't mention this earlier, but speaking of pine bark beetles, we're seeing pine bark beetles spread so fast because of climate change. Where I live in Montana, there used to be a cold snap in midwinter, and that would perform sort of a check on the population of pine bark beetles. Didn't mean they didn't occur. They've been a part of the landscape for a long time. But now, not only do they have a longer season, but they're so successful that they're not having offspring just once a year, but now twice a year. And there are some places where it looks like they may be able to start managing three times reproductive cycles a year. And so that's just generating lots more insect threat than we've ever had before.
So I have kind of a political question for you. The logging companies have long been promoters of what you described as a fire prevention measure, thinning, except what they usually mean by that is going in and hauling out the most attractive lumber, because that's what is most economical for them. You're describing a practice whereby the small trees that serve as fuel ladders are selectively taken out, I'm guessing by hand in a lot of places. That can't be something that a timber company could do profitably.
Yes, you're right, and especially by hand. So when we talk about selective thinning, we're certainly likely going to be talking about either doing it along or from existing road systems, or you're going to have to put new road systems in, and that's fraught with all kinds of other problems. There's certainly wildland areas and ecosystems that should not have roads put in them. It's an open gateway to invasive species. Certain animals, including grizzly bears and others, wolverines, are very, very susceptible to human intrusion. So that's not a good idea in a lot of places. However, the bright spot that's on the horizon now is these small trees, which you correctly point out aren't worth all that much, are suddenly starting to be worth more because of something called laminate beam construction. There are only, I think, a couple, one in the Northwest and one in Western Montana, there may be more on the way, of industries that take small timber, chip them, and then have discovered a process whereby they can be mixed with resin and create super, super strong beams. And they're making, in Portland, Oregon right now, entire 4- and 5-story buildings out of these wooden beams. So if that industry could get a little help, a little assistance to get its feet on the ground, I think suddenly you would have a market for those smaller trees that you don't have now. And that would be an absolutely essential part of the thinning equation.
Well, if the government goes into a contract to do fire prevention in national forests through thinning, whose job is it to keep an eye on the loggers to make sure that they are taking the small trees that serve as fuel ladders and not the big ones that deliver, you know, really beautiful straight grain timber?
Yes, it's typically the responsibility of whatever agency happens to be in charge of managing that land. So it could be the state of California, it could be the National Forest Service, it could be the Bureau of Land Management, it could be the Bureau of Indian Affairs, although they're sovereign governments, so they have their own arrangements going. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of people have been cut from those kinds of positions in the last few years, and the future is not particularly bright for those working in conservation. So our management, the people who are supposed to sort of guard the hen house, has really never been thinner. That said, I do think the people who are in those agencies on the ground monitoring, and in fact, those agencies actually will go out and mark with paint the timber that's acceptable for that company to take. They're supposed to then check the loads of logs going out to make sure that they have been marked appropriately. There are certainly ways to get around that, but that's how the system is supposed to work, and hopefully we'll be able to keep up with that kind of management and that oversight in the years to come.
In terms of changes in budgeting, I also read that the Trump administration has cut the budget of the regional climate centers that are used to provide data to help control and prevent wildfires. Is that something that you are familiar with?
I am familiar with it. I think it's tragic, short-sighted. I'm trying to keep my words from being too inflammatory. It absolutely dooms us potentially, or it is a step that helps doom us as a nation to not be able to use science to the best of our ability to manage the kinds of threats and life-threatening situations that are happening on the ground right now related to wildfire and related to other things having to do with climate change as well. So I think it's actually almost a criminal act to do that, knowing what we know. This is just something that drives me and a lot of other people crazy. The science is in, the consensus is in. It's time we use our very, very clever, intelligent brains and sophisticated technology to put, to put into place so that we can prevent the worst of the effects of these things happening. And we're just kicking the can down the road so that the next generation will have to deal with it in even more dire terms.
But I'm guessing the argument coming out of the Trump administration, and it's not terribly different from the analysis you're presenting, is going to be something along the lines of, look, the Western United States is a place that burns regularly. This is not an emergency. It's something you should plan for. You shouldn't be building homes in fire-prone areas. And we're not going to use federal money to bail you out when the highly predictable happens.
Well, yes, but if you start factoring in what's the cost to the nation and the world, but let's just focus on the nation, what's the cost to the nation from losing big, big public forests? Both in increased carbon dioxide production, or carbon release, I should say, as the forests burn, so making the climate change problem even worse. What's the community cost of ruining watersheds and having them silt up, having toxic releases of heavy metals, which happens whenever an old growth forest burns? Massive amounts of mercury and lead and arsenic are released into the water systems. What's the consequence to the community and the public water system in a community downstream to have to deal with that level of purging of toxic chemicals? So this isn't just about people's houses being threatened. This is about the welfare of all of us. And as that climate change increases, of course, it's not just about forests anymore. It's about the energy that's created in wind events, hurricanes, tornadoes. It's about rising sea levels threatening millions and millions of people along the coast. So it's time for a kind of an adult, mature, long-term view instead of this, what will satisfy my political base in this particular moment. That is the stuff of children, and we need to move into a more mature position.
And isn't it actually somewhat, I guess, ironically, that the people who you would presume more likely to be the Trump's base, they're more holding the position of get the firefighters in here and put out the fire immediately. As soon as we see smoke, put out the fire. And the more quote-unquote liberal voice is the one calling for letting fires burn, having prescribed burns, using the natural course of fire to address part of this problem.
Well, and I certainly can appreciate the feeling on either side. It's worthy of a careful look. The problem, and the Forest Service started out in the 1920s when we were determined to put out every fire. The Forest Service had this 9 a.m. rule they launched completely out of their fantasy imaginations that any fire that broke out in the West that the Forest Service was on the land managing, they would have it out by 9 o'clock the next morning. That's insane. It's completely impossible. And when you put the added fuel now, 100 years later, that's on the ground with the climate change and the fuel moisture loads, it's hard for us to conceive, because we have such faith and in our firefighters and in our technology and in how clever we are, and we are all that. We have nothing to do when big fires get rolling but get out of the way. Most of the firefighters at the Carr Fire, besides fighting fire, have been pulled off time and time again to get out of the way, go help with evacuations and rescues and things like that. These fires are beyond what anybody with any amount of technology can touch. And that's just a fact. Now, the other problem with put them out immediately is we get another year, another 5 years, another 10 years of the fuel load burning up. Remember those 60 million trees that died? What happens when they start toppling 5 or 6 years after the initial death? Okay, we've put out the fire immediately now. Now, 5 years later, we've got a bunch more fuel load. Are we going to be able to put it out the next time? So we're just, again, I use that analogy of kicking the can down the road. Just putting out the fires as quickly as possible is not enough.
Gary Ferguson, I know we've kept you longer than we booked you for. Really appreciate it. Fascinating discussion. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks to both of you.
Gary Ferguson is a longtime environment writer. His newest book is Land on Fire: The New Reality of Wildfire in the West.